Hello and welcome to the Humans and Vents Cycling Podcast. I'm Richard Moore and I'm with Daniel Freeb.
Hi Richard.
And Lionel Burney.
Hello Richard.
Lionel, where are we?
We are in Humans and Vents HQ.
The Nerve Centre.
Yeah, not far from Farringdon in central East London.
We're not in a pub, we're close to a pub, aren't we?
We are.
Slaughtered Lamb.
Yeah.
Just Lamb to the Slaughter, what a great link.
Today we're going to talk quickly about last week's discussion that we had with Jonathan Vauters. We're going to do a little debrief of that. Then we're going to talk about some of the news this week, some of the cycling news this week about the Vuelta, the Giro, Alessandro Balan. Then we're going to talk a little bit about Lance Armstrong and UCI Commission. And we're going to have an update on our competition.
The Humans and Vents Cycling Podcast. Interviews and analysis. We've got the big talking points covered.
First, we had a exclusive interview with Jonathan Vauters last week, which an awful lot of people listened to, so thank you very much for that. And there was a lot of reaction to it, most of it positive, which is nice.
Not positive in that way?
No, not in that way, no, in a kind of, you know, pat on the back sort of way.
Yeah.
Lionel, what were your thoughts after that? I mean, we had 25 minutes with Jonathan. We threw a lot of the questions at him that had occurred to us in the previous week's discussion of Ryder Hesjedal. I mean, was there anything that, you know, when you came back and you listened to it again, you digested some of what he said, was there anything that particularly stuck out?
I think what stuck out was the fact that Jonathan and his organisation have taken this, as he put it, he's started this journey walking through a long, dark tunnel and he's halfway through and it's too late to back up, I think is what he said, and so he's just going to carry on. And I think actually listening to him describe the processes they've been through and the goal of what they're trying to do, which is to run a clean team and to set a kind of a benchmark really for other teams to perhaps follow. You know, they have taken progressive, positive steps to run an organisation that where in another sort of half generation's turnover of riders, there will be young riders coming into that organisation that don't, you know, have not even brushed shoulders with anyone who's doped or offered doping facilities. And so there's an awful, as we said, there's an awful lot of positives there. But the difficulty is that having only half of that message in the light has been the kind of the point where they've stumbled a bit recently. And I think the point that came across most really was that he does sometimes appear to be a bit of a punch bag for the sport. If something goes wrong, lash out at Jonathan Vauters, because he's out there on this kind of, on his own, on this wobbly branch, and every time there's anyone shakes the base of the tree, you know, he gets it. And I think this debate is not being had at all in other teams.
No, that leads on to, we're going to talk about BMC in a minute, but yeah, I wonder, you know, Jonathan is also in the middle of studying for an MBA. Do you think he'll stick around in cycling? Do you think he's in it for the long haul?
I do, because I think he sees a future that is not necessarily radically different, but certainly quite different to the way the sport is run and operated at the moment. I think we all know, you know, he's made presentations to all of the key people that run the sport, whether that be the UCI or ASO or RCS, who run the Tour and the Giro respectively, kind of outlining some of the problems that he sees in terms of making a secure, stable sport financially. And I think one of his arguments is always that one of the things that allows doping in the door is this kind of insecurity that hangs over all teams because they're entirely sponsor dependent. And I mean, he did say in our other chat that it's people who put money into cycling are not investors, they are donors, sponsors. They're not getting any kind of return on that investment other than sort of publicity and advertising spend. And I think he sees a different future for the sport, and I think he'll be around long enough to try and effect some of that change. I think that's what motivates
him. Yeah, I mean, I think it's more the money than the uncertainty that drives doping. The rewards that are there, and you know, the vision that he has for cycling is to make it a more lucrative sport, to have a, you know, to attract more money, basically.
So you're turning the point around that if more money's involved, there'll be greater rewards for...
Potentially.
Yeah.
I mean, my thoughts after our chat with him were, again, more questions for Travis Tiger and USADA, US Anti-Doping Agency, than for Jonathan Waters. You know, I did make the point last week about how would he feel if another team owner had that sort of close relationship with the head of, you know, the anti-doping body. You know, I'm not... although, you know, Jonathan obviously knows that his motives are sound and his principles are correct, you know, would he necessarily automatically trust somebody else to have the same end goal and to achieve that through that relationship? I mean, it is odd that an athlete can confess to doping, even outside the statute of limitations, and not be punished, as Ryder Hegedal was not, and not to be sort of put provisionally suspended until that case has been investigated. And USADA have been not very forthcoming about how long this investigation involving Ryder Hegedal is going to last. But it does seem slightly strange that they could, you know, they could potentially last year, Ryder Hegedal could have won the Tour de France, say. And USADA know that that he has doped in the past. What would be their kind of position there? What would, you know, what kind of... That would be an uncomfortable place for them, I would have thought.
Well, it would, but leading... We don't want to prejudice the discussion about truth and reconciliation, but at some point there has to be a... you know, you say about the statute of limitations, but there has to be a point at which some of these offences do sort of lapse. I think...
It's a tricky one, isn't it?
One of the things that, you know, that came out of it most for Jonathan is that whenever I kind of get lulled into seeing things in black and white, a conversation like the one we had with him last week just shows you that it's a whole spectrum of greys. It's not there isn't a clear and easy path, and perhaps that's where his tunnel analogy.
There's some grey in that tunnel.
It doesn't go.
It's a grey tunnel rather than a black tunnel.
It's more like a sort of dark subterranean maze.
Daniel, you're here as well.
Yeah, I am. Just one thing I suppose jarred with me before the interview, and still jars slightly, this idea that it was impossible for Ryder Hegedal, or certainly very much inadvisable for Ryder Hegedal to confess publicly before he was actually almost forced into doing it. Yeah, outed by the publication of the Rasmussen book. Now, I seem to remember that during the Balco case, this was a policy of USADA. The Balco drug scandal was a very famous drug scandal, almost the athletics equivalent of Festina, involving some top sprinters notably. And I seem to remember that Travis Tygart did adopt that policy, certainly with the majority of athletes in Balco, that they had confessed long before they disclosed their previous doping publicly. However, I don't think that this is a policy that's necessarily been observed across other anti-doping agencies. I'm fairly certain that there have been instances of riders, athletes voluntarily confessing their doping while investigations are ongoing. Let's not forget, this is not a criminal investigation anymore. Jonathan Waters, I think when we were talking to him after the interview, he was very keen to point out that he understands the legal implications of you know, someone going public with information that is vital to an investigation, because this can prejudice the investigation, this can compromise their credibility as a witness. However, it is not a criminal investigation anymore. It was at one point with Armstrong involving Jeff Levitsky, and it's not anymore.
Mm. Yeah, I wonder sometimes whether Jonathan's kind of, you know, legal knowledge, his father was a lawyer, whether that sort of, in a way, kind of hampers him a little bit, hampers his entire sort of thought process, because he's always trying to think 3-4 steps down the line of every possible decision that they take. I think that was the other thing that, you know, people who think that all of these things are, having just said that, people who think every step is calculated to the nth degree, I think it was quite revealing that he said, you know, the statement that they put out, they were under pressure to get it out quickly, but Ryder was in Hawaii where he lives, and, you know, there's a whole sort of, you know, an infrastructure that had to kind of slot into place before they could make their point public. And of course, the longer with social media, the longer they remain silent, the worse it kind of looks. And I think they're playing all of this out in a public arena now. And I wonder whether, I think that with the Truth and Reconciliation, I know a lot of people have said there's no chance of it working because people will still not want to come forward and say what they know publicly. But the alternative is that we just have this kind of every so often, we have something like this rear itself, either around the big races or if a particular rider wins a race who's got a skeleton in the cupboard, something will come out eventually about anyone who's got something to hide.
This is the Humans Invent Cycling Podcast with Richard Moore, Lionel Burney and Daniel Free.
Yeah, this is a point we did make last week, that we do spend a lot of time talking about the anti-doping policies of Garmin Sharp and Team Sky in particular, and we don't perhaps dwell very much on the complete absence of such policies in other teams. And one team I'd like to talk about is BMC, whose rider Alessandro Balan CONI, the Italian Olympic Committee, have called for a 2-year ban. He's suspected of blood transfusions, I think, back in 2008, the year that he became world champion.
Yeah, there's an interesting background story to this. Well, one, Balan's alibi, or his excuse, which has been made public today, I think, is that he was actually taking ozone therapy, which can take various different forms, but he's suggesting that, I think it was an ozone therapy which involves taking the blood out, pumping it with some kind of, I don't know what it is, it's some kind of ozone, whatever ozone does. Or
that's CFC. That's where the ozone layer is going.
Exactly.
In transfused into Alessandro Balan's body.
And then put straight back in. Now this, a lot of people have mocked this today, but it is consistent with the dates of the transfusions, because I think he's accused of having had about 10 transfusions in very quick successions, which is pretty much inconceivable if they were blood transfusions. However, there is other evidence, there are other phone taps, etc., incriminating him to do with other substances, other methods. And another interesting element to this story is that I know that the period in question, the period during which he's alleged to have had these transfusions, whatever they were, whether it was ozone, whether it was blood, for oxygen transporting purposes, that was a period when Team Sky were very, very interested in signing Balan.
They were. They came in 2009. They were, I believe an offer was made around about the time of Milan San Remo, and then subsequently withdrawn. Say no more than that, but no. In 2009 an offer was made and subsequently withdrawn.
Nothing to do with the fact that his passport profile was like a child.
Well, he said one of the things he said today actually is that his passport is absolutely good and proper, Gov. But I think they studied his passport and decided that it was too much of a risk, and it makes you wonder about the due process at BMC, or the due diligence rather at BMC, because it's fair to say there's been a suspicion around Alessandro Balan for a couple of years.
Yeah, and I know that he signed his initial contract with BMC. I think he's perhaps on his second contract now, but it was certainly a sum considerably below what you would expect a recent world champion to be earning.
What are your experiences of working with the BMC team, though? Because to me, it's almost always been like, you know, whereas Sky, Garmin, and some others are very open and very approachable, BMC grant almost no access to anybody for anything. Their press conference, even at sort of the classics, are completely controlled by George Lushinger, who selects who's going to ask the question.
Very tightly controlled.
And there are certain things, you know, to get any one-on-one time with any of their riders is nigh on impossible.
I think
and Okovic gives this kind of almost godfatherly influence over the team. And the 2011 tour, was it when... 2010 tour, when Landis's allegations were first made public. You know, they just fronted that out. They just played a straight back to everything and just carried on regardless. And similarly with Balan and Sant'Ambrogio, isn't it? On the team.
You know, they've had this, on the team, yeah.
Yeah, who was on the team. Yeah. They've had this hanging over them and successive springs it seemed to come up, this story, and the first time BMC did withdraw them from racing, and then the next couple of times they didn't.
Their policy is just to ignore literally ignore it.
Yeah.
I mean, we've all been reading Wheelmen, the new book about the Armstrong scandal by a couple of Wall Street Journal business reporters, and there's some interesting detail in there, but you read that and you look at the history of Jim Okovitz and some of the allegations he made against him in there about his knowledge and involvement in the doping that went on at Motorola, subsequently also at US Postal, and his involvement with Floyd Landis and so on, and the advice he allegedly gave to Floyd Landis when he tested positive. And Andy Reese as well, who's obviously the owner of
up until this summer, John Lelong as well, who's now gone. Who needed to go really for reasons, those reasons, his supposed association with Floyd Landis, but also I think he was not getting on with Philippe Gilbert. I understand Philippe Gilbert even gave the team an ultimatum this year, either it was Lelong left or he left.
That must have been a close call.
Yeah.
But you wonder how these guys can go on just ignoring these claims that are out there, these allegations that are out there. It is remarkable, really.
Yeah, I mean, it's a team with a massive budget, which has not really been run like a team, team in the sort of super league of professional cycling outfits. Not only on this level in terms of transparency, in terms of anti-doping, but also in terms of their results, the number of very high profile, very highly paid riders who have gone there and gone backwards. There's a feeling I know among a lot of other riders that they don't spend their money as wisely, not only in terms of rider recruitment, but in terms of technical support, in terms of training, etc., as teams like Sky and even teams like Green Edge.
Some of the French teams.
So, I mean, there need to be changes there just from a sporting point of view. I think Alan Piper came in at the start of last year and had not limited responsibility, but certainly wasn't the main man in terms of the sporting side of the team this year until Lelong left halfway through the year. I think from next year you will see a big improvement across the team. I think they've been lifted until now by a couple of riders' performances, like Cadel Evans obviously winning the Tour, Gilbert winning the World Championship last year. But I think next year we'll probably see a better, more professional looking BMC outfit. But that doesn't alter the fact, like you said, Rich, there are some very certainly some grey areas there.
Well, the dilemma for the sport and for Brian Cookson, and because when Pat McQuaid was president, none of this stuff really mattered to him or the UCI. But the allegations just contained within the book Wheelmen, and the stuff we've all kind of known about, and if you were to draw just a spider diagram of somebody like Jim Okovic and look at all of the teams he's been involved in and all of the things that have happened, and you could do it with other individuals as well, the sport's got a choice to make here. You either have a kind of truth and reconciliation commission, which is what's been proposed, and you try to offer a kind of an incentive based way for people to be open and honest about what they've been involved in the past, or you have some kind of fit and proper person test for team ownership and team management, and you either take one path or the other, I think, and so otherwise, you know, the same mistakes of the past will just keep being repeated, and so in the case of sort of Balan, you know, this is like the third time. This Mantova investigation has been going on for so long; it's reared its head three times. And if they do suspend him, you would expect that, given the landscape of the way the sport is trying to go, you would expect a strong response from BMC of some kind. Now, that could be rehabilitation after a suspension, or it could be a zero tolerance. But you would expect something other than just a flat back, which is what they normally do.
Well, let's move on from that to the news this week. That
very serious, Paul.
This is serious, yeah.
It's extremely serious.
It is. We'll be looking up a bit.
When are we going to call Ciro?
We're going to call Ciro soon, Daniel. He's coming soon.
Not today.
Don't worry. Not today. Review of the year next week.
Okay.
Patience.
He'll be on a beach. He's always on a
beach.
Patience.
Don't worry. We're making arrangements with him as we speak.
I think he's wrecking stages for his. What did he call the beach? The beach grand tour.
Giro de la Plage.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah.
I don't know.
I preferred serious.
We had the news this week of cooperation agreed between WADA and UCI to set up this commission, which is the investigation. It's not truth and reconciliation. It's investigation into the past and perhaps building a framework for a truth and reconciliation commission, perhaps. Now, Lionel, you and I both spoke to Brian Cookson a couple of weeks ago, but a lot of the points he talked about were about this commission, about his first few weeks in office. And we're going to play both of those interviews now, so I think you'll hear him talking first to Lionel and then to me. So here's the president of the UCI, Brian Cookson.
Brian Cookson, congratulations on winning the election to presidency of the UCI. It struck me from observing the proceedings on election day that your moment of decisiveness perhaps swung it for you as things threatened to sort of snowball, not to put it too unpolitely, into a bit of a farce. Was that something that just struck you as somebody needed to seize the bull by the horns and get on with it?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I've been to enough congresses and national councils and annual general meetings over the years to sense the mood of those kind of things. And clearly there have been a long and very frustrating kind of interlude of interventions from lawyers and people from the floor, and people were so annoyed and upset and frustrated that it was very timely to make that intervention. And I think everyone welcomed it, even Pat McQuaid, who I think he thought that he was going to win if it went to the vote. And I think it certainly seemed to have a good impact on anybody who was wavering. It may have swung a few, but I think quite a lot of people were mandated anyway, so I'm not so sure whether it differs to the number of votes, maybe two or three, but then, you know, that could have been what made the difference. Yeah.
And you've been in the job a few weeks now. What have you been up to in that time, and what have you found to be the priorities?
Yeah, well, my feet haven't really touched the ground. The key thing that we did was, I mean, on the Monday after the World Championships, we got on the train and took Tracy Godfrey, one of the new vice presidents, with me, and we went 4 o'clock that afternoon. We got to Aigle and just had a quick meeting with some of the key staff, and then the next day we met all of the staff, and I explained to them a few of the things that what we were going to try and do that were in the manifesto, and that we were not subject to any influence of anybody from outside of the UCI or the sport or anything like that, and that we were going to do things that we said in the manifesto, and that we were going to run the UCI with integrity, probity, and the highest standards of honesty and legality. And that's the way that we've done things at British Cycling. That's the way that I now intend to do things at the UCI. And some of those things have been sadly lacking, and we hope to bring a new standard. The things that we've announced already seem to have been well received. I'm very, very pleased with that. And lots more to do. Some things we can, flick a switch and change overnight. Other things, you know, it's more, changing the direction of an oil tanker kind of thing. Some things take longer time. What I find everywhere I go is that people are just so pleased that there's been change at the top of the UCI. They think that there are some important things that need change, some good things still going on at UCI that we can build upon. And I'm really, really happy the way things have gone. I feel like we're pushing at an open door. There's still work to do, and will continue to be. And no doubt there'll be problems that come up that we haven't even thought of yet, and there'll be controversies. But I think we've made a great start, and I'd like to think, and I'm confident we can carry on doing more and better.
And obviously the Tour de France is the pinnacle of professional cycling,
yeah.
Certainly. It's the flagship event. It's the event everybody knows and thinks of when they think of cycle racing. The UCI and ASO haven't had the best relationship at times in the past decade. How key is that relationship between the UCI and not just the organisation, but Monsieur Amaury and Christian Prudhomme?
Well, I think clearly ASO and the Tour de France, they are one of the most important stakeholders in the sport of cycling, certainly professional road cycling. I have had good relations with them for a number of years, since going back to the days of the Grand Départ in London. There have been some changes in personnel over the years there, and I've got a good relation with Yann Lemonnier, Christian Prudhomme, and I've met most of the Amaury family. Madame Amaury was here today, and had a nice discussion with her, and Jean-Claude also. So you know, I think we can work with them and they want to work with us. And, you know, the whole landscape of battles that have been so significant and so damaged the UCI in recent years, we're all walking away from that now. We want to walk into a world where we work together in partnership and in harmony. And, you know, I think that actually there is a real will to do that out there. There's a real desire to work properly in partnership.
But you said that your first day in office you would make the call to WADA.
Yeah, did that.
You made that call. How did that go?
Very good. And I've had that was to David Hallman, who was the Director General. I've subsequently talked to John Fay, the President, and had very, very positive support from him. I'm very confident that we can make good progress there and that they will be supportive. We will make sure that what we propose for the Commission is in line with their objectives and their requirements, and they will, I'm sure, work hard with us to make sure that we can deliver.
And what's the timescale for that? And is there a danger that this will again, once again, dredge up
nope.
the past?
Oh, well.
Are you, does that concern you?
The timescale is that we will be putting a proposal to our management committee on Tuesday, and I hope to make an announcement not long after that about the way which we will handle the whole process. I'm very hopeful that it can be concluded in a matter of months rather than years, but I don't want to prejudge that at the moment because we need to make sure that, you know, as I've been saying all the way through this process, you know, what's important is that people support the process. They don't read about it in the media, you know, that Cookson has said this and WADA have said that and so on. That we bring everyone together and make an agreement, and I'm sure we can do that.
I presume the findings will be made public as well.
Yeah.
And that, would you like that to be done and dusted by the time next year's tour starts?
That might be a bit ambitious, but we'll confirm the timescale next month. And we will be publishing something. There may have to be bits that may have to be redacted and so on, but we will certainly publish the outcome.
And just finally, Brian, you're 3 weeks into the job. I mean, it was an acrimonious election campaign. How is the atmosphere at the UCI? Have you been able to sort of build bridges with some of the people that were supporting
Pat
McQuaid?
Yeah. Well, the two, unfortunately, we've had to make two senior people changes at the top. Christoph Hubschmidt, the Director General, has gone. We've agreed terms with him. And Philip Verbeest, the UCI's long-term legal counsel, has gone, and we've agreed terms with him as well. That's allowed us to make some really important changes. I think we've got external legal advice now that I think will improve the situation of how we handle things, and we're making some good changes internally in the management as well. Martin Gibbs has come with me from my campaign as now my Chief of Staff, and I'll be making further adjustments as time goes by.
Are you spending a lot of time there at the moment?
I'm there virtually full time, although I am jetting around quite a bit. I've been across to Beijing and back, so my feet have hardly touched the ground, but I've got myself a temporary apartment, and my wife and I looked, and I think we found somewhere more permanent to live from next month, and in Montreux, and I'm very much looking forward to
it. Are you enjoying it?
Yeah, it's absolutely brilliant, Richard. Yeah, I'm really loving it, because it's not, I'm not saying it's going to be easy, it isn't. It's difficult, there are some difficult challenges ahead, but the goodwill that there is around, you've seen, maybe seen that today, and the fact that I'm sat next to the top people from ASO there, they really want to work with us. All of those people, whether it's WADA, AFLD, race organisers, teams, they all want to work forward in this new start, and I want to work with them, and I'm sure we can do that.
And you must have a good relationship with Craig Reedy.
Yeah, I know Craig very well.
President of WADA.
Yeah, you won't be surprised to hear that. I've spoken to Craig Reedy quite a bit on the phone, and I'm confident that what we agree with John Farr here, whilst he's in place till the end of December, will be picked up and supported.
You're listening
by Craig as well.
To the Humans Invent Cycling Podcast, powered by Sharp.
Right, let's lighten this up a bit. Competition time, mystery voice. Nobody has got the mystery voice yet.
Okay.
Yes. Had lots of guesses, so we've only played one very brief clip of the mystery voice. We're going to play the second clip now, which is a little bit longer. Here it is.
But now, as more and more comes out.
So that was a little bit of a longer clip of our mystery voice. We've had lots of guesses so far, but it is not Adam Hansen, Chris Horner, Matt White, David Zabriskie, Levi Leipheimer, Michael Rogers, Simon Gerrans, Richie Port, Matt Goss, Robbie McEwen or Christian van der Velde, and there were a few others as well, but it's none of those people. The winner of this this competition will receive a copy of, I can't remember what was the prize.
Oh,
it was a copy of my Tour de France 100 book.
Yeah.
So this week we'll add in, what will we add?
We'll add in the three cycling anthologies.
Three cycling anthologies. Yeah. Right, there we go. And something else will be added to that next week if nobody gets it. So here it is again, the mystery voice.
But now, as more and more comes out.
If you want to guess the mystery voice, please tweet at humansinvent, hashtag mystery voice. At humansinvent, hashtag mystery voice. A copy of Tour de France 100 and all three cycling anthologies, volumes 1, 2 and 3.
The Cycling Podcast with humansinvent.com. Innovation, craftsmanship and design.
So let's lighten up a bit more though, and compared to doping this will be lightening up a bit, but the proposal this week, and I'm pretty sure Lionel will have strong feelings about this, the proposal to perhaps cut the Giro and the Vuelta from 3 to 2 weeks. Lionel, what do you make of that?
Well, change is coming, isn't it? We are going to have a radically different, I think, race programme by 2020. Whatever happens, there will be change. And one of the proposals is to shorten two of the Grand Tours, which instinctively people react against, because the thing that makes the Grand Tours grand is that difficult third week. It separates, it takes the events from being tough into sort of almost superhuman. It gives them their mythical status. It enables them to have some successive mountain stages and higher, harder challenges. But the Vuelta as a as the third of the Grand Tours, and we could perhaps debate where this term Grand Tour even comes from, because it's almost certainly an invention of a journalist somewhere. It's not an
and
official,
quite a recent term,
and it is a very recent thing. I mean, in the 80s nobody referred to these races as the Grand Tours. This is a pretty recent thing.
If you reduce the Vuelta to 2 weeks, there'd be 11 summit finishes, 2 rest days and presumably one sprint stage.
It's already sounding better. But the Vuelta in the mid 80s was not 3 weeks long. It was 2.5. Sometimes only it was 3 weekends long.
The Tour of Portugal used to be 3 weeks.
Yeah, so I don't know the Giro's history quite as well,
yes.
But the Giro's always been 3 weeks.
Yes.
Yeah. But so the Vuelta, it's not set in stone that it must be 3 weeks. And I think, given the economic challenges of not only organising those races, I mean, let's not forget the Vuelta is at the moment propped up by ASO, really. They bought it out. They've kind of kept it going. And if it's a challenging old time out there, television rights for the Vuelta I don't think are particularly big. Races in Spain are falling off the calendar left, right and centre.
A couple of years ago, the Vuelta they were punting their live broadcast of foreign broadcasters for around about £30,000, I think.
That's right, yeah. Mm. Yeah,
I think that's what ITV picked up for, wasn't
yeah.
it, when they started broadcasting something
which is
very small.
Yeah,
the calendar I think is going to look different, and it's just about negotiating what changes and what stays the same. And I think the things that are almost sacrosanct are the Tour de France, the World Championship Road Race and the 5 big one day races, and pretty much everything else is up for debate. No?
Yeah, I mean, the Vuelta has enjoyed something of a resurgence, at least superficially, in the last couple of years, because the racing's been exciting and there have been people at the roadside. You ask a Spanish journalist why there all of a sudden is this increase in the number of fans at the roadside, they say it's because everyone's unemployed and
exactly.
they've got nothing better
yeah.
to do.
Yeah.
So it's perhaps a bit misleading. But the sport and the health of the sport in the old Europe, and certainly or the old cycling world, certainly southern Europe, is a major concern. In Italy and Spain, every year, inevitably now, there are races being lost, there are teams being lost. And yes, there are good arguments for two week Vuelta, 2 week Giro, but is this just going to be accelerate this kind of eating away process, which will leave us with almost nothing in those countries? And we've seen, I've mentioned before, how vulnerable, how fragile cycling is in countries where it is a new phenomenon, it's newly popular. We saw what happened in Germany with, it boomed for 10 years on the back of, or sort of on Jan Ullrich and Erik Zabel's coattails. It kind of dissolved to nothing then. And we've got a lot of countries at the moment that seem to be enjoying this absolute explosion in interest, and it all seems very healthy and it all seems like it's going to last, but we can't be sure of that. And if then we have no kind of bedrock to fall back on, no Spanish cycling scene, no Italian cycling scene, then it does worry you slightly about the future of the
and where those sport. Where cycling does sort of take off, as it did in Germany, as it then did in the US in the 90s, it seems limited, the development. You only have one team. You know, in Germany, yeah, there was Milram came on, but there was really a monopoly there by T-Mobile. In the US, it was US Postal. In the UK, it's Sky. In Australia, it's Orica GreenEdge. Whereas, you know, traditionally in France and Belgium, Spain, Italy, there have been, although in Italy struggling at the moment, but there are a lot of teams. We've not got a situation yet where in one of those new territories a multitude of teams has developed and prospered. It's always been a monopoly and therefore almost inevitably very, very fragile, very dependent on that one team.
We saw how fragile it was only last year, that the noticeable difference between the coverage in Great Britain of Wiggins winning the Tour de France in 2012 and the coverage of Froome, simply because it had been done before and people had been become slightly blasé about it. Froome was perhaps less kind of mediagenic than Wiggins, so even there you saw that it's very fickle.
Yeah, I mean, going back to the sort of calendar of races, which I think we all can agree does desperately need some reworking and some work.
I haven't voiced an opinion on that.
No, you haven't, but we'll come
bludgeoning
to
that. Bludgeoning me into consensus there, like.
I mean, two of us perhaps can agree that there's some changes need to be made. And I'm an arch traditionalist. You know, I liked the cycling calendar that, as I first discovered it, the
you
races
turned up in a tweed cap today.
it's winter. The races in the Mediterranean area and northern Italy in February as the kind of training races, and then the Ruta del Sol in the south of Spain a little bit later, and then sort of Het Volk signaled the start of the classics, and the Vuelta was in the spring back when I first started watching and reading about cycling. I say watching, none of it was on TV, so reading about cycling. So the Vuelta has always been the kind of the third of the so-called three grand tours anyway. And the move to sort of mid, the height of summer, I don't think did much for it. Even with the World Championships coming after it, so some riders do use it as preparation for that.
A lot of them drop out after 2 weeks.
Exactly, yeah.
Ironically.
And I mean, I will defend sort of Paris-Nice and Het Volk for no better reason than sort of sentimentality, really, just because they have a history about them. But I think being pragmatic about it, you know, if there's going to be some changes made, as Daniel says, preserve some of the bedrock of the sport. And I think one way to preserve the bedrock of the sport is to have, a two-week Vuelta rather than no Vuelta.
This is an area that it will be interesting to see if during Brian Cookson's first mandate becomes very pertinent, this idea of kind of protectionism almost of these countries. I mean, I really do think the situation is that bad in Italy and Spain. It is withering on the vine before your eyes, and I can foresee a situation in 2 or 3 years where some kind of intervention will need to be done because the money is simply not coming in, the sponsorship is not coming in. I was writing a feature about Portuguese cycling and the impact that Rui Costa's World Championship victory will have on the domestic scene there. Well, it will have almost no impact as far as I can see. Town councils, who were a real mainstay there of sponsorship of cycling teams, have now been banned from sponsoring cycling teams simply because it costs too much. The minimum wage there, which almost everyone is on, almost all of the domestic pros is on, is €700 a month before tax. And that just gives you an idea of how desperate the situation is there.
I mean, Alessandro Balan is a metaphor for Italian cycling, isn't he? And he's an infusion of ozone or something. Italy's last world champion as well.
So come on, Rich.
Shot in the arm, it needs, doesn't it?
Shot in the arm. I do agree with you, actually, Lionel. Reluctantly, I do agree with you. Even now, you know, even a race like the Tour Down Under, which has sort of developed a tradition and a sort of its own heritage and has fantastic crowds, it doesn't for some reason get the blood pumping in the way that Paris-Nice or even the Tour of the Med that you said, but that could just be our age. It could just be age. We got in, you know, the age at which I got into cycling, when you're most like a sponge soaking it all up, when you're in your teens and you're absolutely engrossed and fascinated by this new sport, you develop this romantic notion of it, and that remains kind of fixed, I think. And so we could just be held back by our own sentiment there.
And it's also worth pointing out that the calendar has always evolved, and some of the races that we now hold very, very dear, like the Tour of the Med, in the grand scheme of things, they're still quite young races.
Yeah, you're right. And you know, the Tour of Down Under is perhaps a bad example, because I've been there a couple of times, and it is, you know, there's a lot to recommend it. But there are other races, obviously, like Tour of Beijing and you know,
Oman, Qatar.
Yeah, Oman, Qatar.
Dubai.
You know, yeah, they just seem that you're just trying to force something on people and on the sport there that just isn't working. And I think you're right, Daniel, that there should be efforts made to preserve the health of the sport in countries where there is a tradition, because that bedrock is important. And you know, we talked about this a lot, but we went to the World Championships in Florence this year, and everywhere, Italian cycling is withering on the vine, but the World Championships had a real presence there, as exemplified by the pictures of Gino Bartali in virtually every shot window. Now, he's fifth, you know, his career ended 60 years ago, but still, that does speak to a tradition there, an understanding of the sport that I think is important, and that you certainly can't replicate overnight in places like the UK or America or Australia. So, I think that. I think there's a lot to be said for some kind of, you know, life support for some of these older, more traditional races. Does that make sense?
It does.
We're going to try and lighten up the next time.
I think it's getting dark.
But in our next podcast, we're going to do a review of the year, and we're going to be joined by Ian Cleverly of Ruler Magazine, and we're going to do a sort of go through our hits and misses of the year, and that we should have a bit of fun with that. I think even Lionel.
Yeah, we'll have a jolly old time. Sure.
So until then, thank you very much, Lionel.
Is that it? Thank you, Richard.
Can we not end on a more rousing note than that? No.
That was quite rousing, I thought. Thanks, Daniel.
Thanks, Rich.
The Humans Invent Cycling Podcast. For more articles, go to humansinvent.com/cycling.